This is another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. Chapter 2 of The Rare Metals War, The Dark Side of Clean Energy and Digital Technologies. The ecological impact of photovoltaic panels on account of their silicon content, producing just one panel generates as much as 70 kilograms of carbon dioxide. The 23% annual increase in the number of solar panels over the next few years will increase their power generation capacity by 10 gigawatts every year, but will also generate 2.7 billion tons of carbon emissions into the atmosphere, or as much pollution as 600,000 vehicles on the road in a year. Thermal solar panels make an even bigger splash, with some consuming as much as 3,500 liters of water per megawatt hour. That's 50% more water than a coal-fired plant. More problematic still is the fact that solar farms are more often than not located in water-scarce areas. There you have selective thinking and cherry-picking to tout the benefits of solar panels. The UCLA researchers reached the conclusion that industrializing electric vehicles is 3 to 4 times more energy-intensive than industrializing conventional cars. John Peterson's conclusion: electric vehicles may be technically possible, but their production will never be environmentally sustainable. I'm just flipping through and reading my highlights. Digital technology requires vast amounts of metals. Every year, the electronics industry consumes 320 tons of gold, 7,500 tons of silver, accounts for 22% of global mercury consumption, and on and on. And this is only the manufacture of digital devices. Operating electric grids will, of course, generate additional digital activity and therefore additional pollution, the effects of which are becoming clearer. A documentary investigating the environmental impact of the internet traces the journey of a simple email. Once it leaves the computer, it reaches the modem, travels down the building to a connection center, transits from an individual cable to national and international exchanges, and then goes through a message host, usually in the U.S. In the data centers of Google, Microsoft, and Facebook, the email is then processed, stored, and sent to its recipient. All told, our emails travel 15,000 kilometers at the speed of light. All of this has an environmental cost. It's calculated that the electrical cost of our digital activities and email with attachment uses as much electricity as a high wattage energy saving light bulb for 1 hour. Every hour, some 10 billion emails are sent around the world. That's 50 gigawatts, or the equivalent output of 15 nuclear power stations for 1 hour. One data center alone uses as much energy as a city of 30,000 inhabitants to manage the flow of data and run its cooling systems. A U.S. study estimated that the information and communication technology sector consumes as much as 10% of the world's electricity and produces 50% more greenhouse gases than air transport annually. And here's one I found interesting. I'll call it a techno ruse, is that it's the sense of, he says, thus the supposedly virtuous shift towards the age of dematerialization is nothing more than an outright ruse, for there is no end to its physical impact. Feeding this digital leviathan will require coal-fired, oil-fired, and nuclear power plants, wind farms, solar farms, and smart grids, all infrastructures that rely on rare metals. So, yeah, there is that sense of, emailing and I guess with Zooming, you see the people, but it's sort of not the same as in the physical presence. But all this sense of online and texting, it has a dematerialized consciousness to it, as if we're not doing anything. But that's the ruse. We forget that all green technology begins prosaically as a gash in the Earth's crust. This new demand on the planet replaces our dependence on oil with addiction to rare metals. We are offsetting deprivation with excess, a bit like drug addicts weaning themselves off cocaine by sinking into heroin. Instead of addressing the challenge of humanity's impact on ecosystems, we are displacing it, and the rate at which we are subjugating today's environmental perils could very well have dire ecological consequences. Now, that's a good film I just watched recently, The Social Dilemma, And that had a quote, if I remember it correctly, it was there was only two industries which call their customers users: illegal drugs and software. Well, I also learned stuff from these kind of books, like iron and carbon gives us steel. Alloys need to be de-alloyed to be recycled. So a lot of these, that's another interesting thing. There's a profusion of new materials: translucent concrete, paper bricks, insulating gels, and reinforced wood that transform the properties of the original material. These alloys are so promising that green technologies will increasingly become dependent on them. But as the name suggests, alloys need to be de-alloyed to be recycled. So there again, all these great inventions, and ooh, isn't that a new cool thing? But if we just think of the product, we are doing a injustice and a disservice to the earth and to the all the beings that are of the metals. Whoa, here's another. These stats are just mind-boggling. 80% of e-waste produced in the U.S. is sent to Asia. Out of sight, out of mind. That's another one of those displacing pollution. The pollution no longer produced in urban areas thanks to electric cars has merely been displaced to the areas where the resources needed for this very technology are mined. The energy and digital transition, therefore, belong to the wealthy. The most affluent areas are relieved of pollution by dumping its impacts on the most destitute and remote areas. Radioactivity of normal mining conditions, that is an issue as well. And that's, I saw that at the Protect Thacker Pass site in Nevada, where there's native teepees now placed in the road to stop the Lithium Americas Corp from mining lithium and just further destroying sacred lands. They already started destroying a massacre site. And the lithium would go to GM. So I looked on GM's website, and there was a picture that it was an aerial view of a bunch of skyscrapers with a road through it, and it said something like no emissions, no crashes, no emissions, blah blah blah. And it was just that. It was the view of civilization, the root of the word of the city, as if it's pure and clean and pristine, and you can just drive around, and it's just bullshit. Some of the green technologies underpinning our modest consumption ideals ultimately require more raw materials to be mined than do older technologies. So that's another one, like in the previous show, the statistic that had oil and fossil fuels, as not even on the top polluter. Now, I don't know how they measure that, because obviously with oil spills, it causes horrific, ruin of rivers and lands and all that. But it is. All these things are worth checking into, because basically there's just so many environmental groups that everybody's like, end fossil fuel, and that's foolish, because you can't. All this green energy runs on fossil; it has to have fossil fuels as well. And chapter D, localized pollution, which I mentioned. Here's a man. There's no such thing as rare earth minerals that are not radioactive. Now that would take more of a sciencey look, but again, that's something to look into. And naturally, buying cheaper improved the French chemical company's bottom line. It was also profitable for its customers, eager to procure transformed rare earths at rock-bottom prices. I had to read that, because I put in the margin, was that a pun intended? Transformed rare earths at rock-bottom prices. And further, the same logic applies to green technologies. In the last two decades of the 20th century, the workload of future energy and digital transition fell naturally between China, which did the dirty work of manufacturing green tech components, and the West, which could then buy the pristine product while flaunting its sound ecological practices. Thus, the world was ordered as Larry Summers intended, between the dirty and those who pretend to be clean. So this again is where I say that, like, nationalism is deceitful, and that countries, to think of countries is inaccurate, because it's a lie to sit there and think about just your country, because, as he said here, China's doing the dirty work of the manufacturing while the West thinks, pretends it's clean. And here's a Chinese academic explains, we are praised for molding to the Western ruled world order of the time, but China also suffered, and in terms of cost effectiveness, I'm not wholly convinced of the advantages in our favor. Under this arrangement, Beijing has effectively laundered dirty minerals, concealing the dubious origins of metals in China, has given green and digital technologies the shining reputation they enjoy. This could very well be the most stunning greenwashing operation in history. And then further on, mentions Tesla and cobalt in the Congo, and consumers could have led the resistance. Their choice to buy or boycott has the power to redirect the market and change its practices. They had the information. Numerous documentaries have exposed the distressing environmental and social impact of electronic goods, as have countless NGO reports. So this is also where a lot of people like to be holier than thou and always point the finger at the corporations. But I make a point in my writings to mention, I point the finger at you. Not you personally. I point the finger at you, whoever's listening. I point the finger at myself. I point the finger at all of us, because all of us, it's all our responsibilities to say how much we participate in or not participate in. And at least if you're going to participate in, do it consciously and talk about the ramifications. Because that could, create more, that could create change. And then there's something called in the U.S., the right to repair movement is gathering pace. It requires electronic goods manufacturers to allow consumers to fix their products by providing them with repair manuals. Well, that's a cool idea to have, not have to be dependent on outside whatever. Again, the sleight of hand, these off-balance sheet transactions that use fraudulent accounting practices have led to the convictions of countless company directors. We glorify our modern ecological legislation while shipping out our electronic scrap to toxic waste dumps in Ghana, exporting our radioactive waste to the ends of Siberia, and outsourcing rare metals mining around the world to make a deadweight loss look like a net profit. Then there's a chapter, The Illusion of a New Era of Opulence. And a lot of these things are not so new. It's the same story for perfumes from the 1950s. Globalization and the low cost of labor led to perfume makers neglecting their flower farms in Grasse in the south of France in favor of less noble products from Egypt, India, or Bulgaria. Perfume was sold based on concepts rather than on the quality of ingredients. So there you have, again, the cheap labor and the brainwashing and the advertising and the image, instead of direct participation, better quality, more respect and care for the people and the energies that actually go into the product. The assumption still exists that resources are available in any quantity at any time. Supporting this utopia are the dogmas of just-in-time and zero stock. Taught in MBA programs the world over and applied by industrial groups, the two production management methods were established in 1962. By Taichi Onyo, an engineer at the Japanese company Toyota, hence the term Toyotaism. Just-in-time is about avoiding surplus stock by making the time between the manufacturer of product and its sale as short as possible, resulting in what is known as lean manufacturing. Its corollary, zero stock, outsources the management of spare parts and components to a multitude of contractors, thereby transferring the risks associated with the delivery of raw materials to these third parties. So all this stuff, anything basically, it just has me realize that anything, any product, anything that's coming out of this colonial capitalist system has some shenanigans, some manipulativeness, some profit motive driven in there that's far outranking the holistic care for the earth and everyone. And you think about it, says the metal without the world would run infinitely slower without them. So much of our pace and lifestyle, that's something to ponder. If you're into pondering the pace and lifestyle that we in general live, is the speed is fueled by these metals and the gadgets and all that. It's a this new pace, a lot of people say it seems like things are going faster. Well, that's in part because of more people are hooked, the level at which we're hooked into the gadgetscape, and that everything revolves around that. And another thing he highlights is that as production lines have scattered and the distances traveled by timber have grown longer, parquet floor layers, carpenters, and the like have become disconnected from the substance of their trade. That again is the part of the sad reality of the physical, the worship of materialization. I was thinking about this, you know, if I were to go to the hardware store and buy a new rake, and I start using that rake, I can pause and, you know, be thankful for the wood and the metal and where those come from, tree that helped that make that, and the metals and the people. But if someone made me a rake, when I go to rake, I would slow down, I would pause and think, and I would be more thankful. And then another layer, if someone gave me a rake, or I was guided by spirit to adorn my rake with feathers or gemstones or something that gave it a symbolic and a spiritual quality, perhaps something along those lines, or it was ceremonially bestowed upon me by someone, that rake then would have even further significance. But the facility and the cheapness that has become of a commodified world has made it so I have to stop and slow down and think about that to even realize, wait a second, this could be more than just a rake. Because everything, ultimately, inherently, everything is from the earth, and with some level of care and consciousness going into it. But if we're just hungry ghosting for the end product like addicts, then we're just in that sense, we're devouring ourselves. So that's why I think it's important, obviously, to have this consciousness that expands beyond the material world and beyond the product. Okay, chapter 4, we're going to do one more chapter, The West Under Embargo. That'll be about halfway through the book. And there's more stats. Congo produces 64%. I had read 75% of the world's cobalt. South Africa, 83% of the world's platinum. Brazil, 90% of the world's niobium. For its beryllium needs, Europe is dependent on the United States, which accounts for over 90% of production. Never heard of beryllium. Now I know the United States has 90% of it. Russia controls 46% of the world's palladium. Turkey, 38% of borate supply. Yttrium, Yttrium, a rare earth used for precision electronics. And, okay, here's where he mentions the title of the book. Secretary of State Clinton, blah, blah, blah. Metals critical to French industry. And on the steps of the White House, President Obama announced America's submission of a trade complaint to the WTO against China. The rare metals war had begun. So that's another layer of the title, is that this is the strategic positioning that has come out of the fight over the metals between U.S. and China. And here, there was an interesting one about the indigenous peoples of Bafokeng, Bafokeng's, happened to be sitting on the biggest platinum deposit in the world. And there, the name of their people translate to the people of the Dew, D-E-W. This was way back, and this has a history to it, 15th century, 1870, so I won't go into all that. But the gist of it was that they had control over the metals, and that was a big difference for the indigenous peoples to control the production of that that metal. And that's similar to how, you know, Hugo Chavez nationalized the oil production, took it away from the global corporate transnational corporations and made it Venezuela, so the money went back into Venezuela, and that causes the powers that do nothing to the powers that so-called be to have a freak out. The control freaks. Material addicts freak out if they can't control stuff. And then the way the market has changed, traditionally the major base metals were the subject of market speculation, but increasingly the rare metals market is too. Speculators include hedge funds such as the Tudor Fund in the U.S., asset managers such as investments firm in the Netherlands, pension funds, as well as the finance departments of U.S. universities such as Harvard and Princeton, according to a banking analyst. Any major position taken in a metal results in wild speculation. One of many examples, the purchase of in 2017 of 17% of global cobalt production, that is several thousand tons, by investors betting on a shortage of cobalt brought on by a sharp price increase. So here I wrote in my notes, gambling with Mother Earth. The prices and what things cost are oftentimes based on these hedge fund banking people that have nothing better to do but gamble and bet on the numbers of these metals, which again, I'm going to mention at some point, the book by Ryan DeLoria Jr., The World We Used to Live In, talks about the indigenous perspective of the stone beings. These are living beings, these metals. They are like, I'll just, off the top of my head, they're like a plant. You can look at a plant, your tomato plant, and your flower, and you see that there's a living being because you watch it grow, and it feeds you, and it makes you feel good when you see a beautiful flower. So, but the tendency is to overlook that these stones and metals are just the same. They are living beings too, but we have been taught through this Western system to think they are nothing and just a rock commodity for our little debauchery of luxury of one-stop shopping and such like. And at the end of this chapter, concluding paragraph, making any kind of forecasts about these ultra-sensitive markets is therefore near impossible. The rare earths market is neither stable nor predictable, Vivian Wu emphasized. Gone are the days when even without regular supplies of rare metals, governments and businesses could at least count on constant market prices to sketch out a strategy. As a specialist from a European geological institution says, rare metals are crisis metals. So that's about halfway through the book. Oh, not too many parts of the show left, I guess. Who knows? So that's about halfway through the book. And after reading and thinking about that while doing this, I realized some of the highlights for me of is how interconnected all these things are, and how the not just the commodification, but then the banking and the gambling on the commodification is like another layer that gets overlooked, and then not just the interconnectedness with the countries, but the as it showed, the simple email, the grid that it must go through. And in that film, The Social Dilemma, they showed some underground, someplace where it was like the computer think tank source that ran everything. And there was so many computers and wires. It was like a warehouse of computers. And it was mind-boggling. And it made me think, like, what if they need to replace the wires? Like, how would they do that? And how would they keep things running? I mean, for everything that there is, there has to be some kind of backup. I mean, that's another thing. In the previous show, I mentioned Jevons' paradox that the more streamlined it gets, the more usage. Well, I think about that with the computer now. You know, I have a computer, but then because of the data is important to me, so I get a backup battery, and then I get an external hard drive to back up my data, and the backup battery charge in case the power goes out. So I have a backup to save data and not ruin things. So it's not just buying a computer. We think, oh, wow, isn't that simple? It's easy access. You just get a computer. No, you have to get a computer. And then if you want to go into any depth of, protecting what you're working on, some people may not care, but most people do. Then there's external hardware drive, backup battery, then the obvious mouse and keyboard and screen and gadget. And if you want to, if I want to transfer my cell phone photos to my computer, I had to get an extra wire to stick that into the computer to transfer the photo. And on it goes. So all these things that seem simplified, and isn't it slick and isn't it fast? And it is to some degree. It's way slicker, faster than waiting a week or a month to get your photos developed. But look at all the hardware that goes into it. And that takes metals. So more stuff to worry about. And thank you and be well.